a pair of brown eyes that was looking at me. But when we got back, labeled parts 1 to 3, there was no pair of brown eyes waiting for me. But a robe and a robe and a robe and I'll go for a pair.
Hello, comrades, and welcome back. Season 3, episode 8 of Spectre. I'm absolutely delighted today to be joined by Dr. Connor McCabe. Connor, it's an absolute pleasure to have you on today.
Ah, cheers, Nathan. Sound.
So just to start off, Connor, if we could just get a kind of introduction from yourself, you know, your affiliations, who you are, and everything in between.
Yeah, I mean, I'm an independent kind of researcher who's based in Ireland, in the south. I work mainly with kind of trade unions and kind of grassroots groups. I try to work with everyone on the left in Ireland, which is quite the achievement. But but because of that, I'm not a member of any group. I never have been. So it's an independent left kind of researcher, you know. And I mainly kind of focus in on Irish kind of capitalism, how it works, its kind of dynamics, and not as an academic kind of exercise, to feed that into kind of groups and, you know, kind of assist in terms of analysis of the class and power dynamics on the island, north and south, you know. So that would be my background, you know. So it's mainly kind of back at shop research. I'm not front of shop. I'm not someone who shouts, you know. So I just like being in the back and kind of researching, and then just like feeding it in, like, you know. There's a role for quiet people like me, even in kind of socialism. So yeah.
No, cheers for that, Connor. That's perfect. And aye, especially when you talk about working with the left, sometimes it's easier to do that in the back rather than for the front.
most definitely. Yeah.
So yeah, I guess just to come on, obviously we'll be talking later on about your book, The Lost and Early Writings of James Connolly, 1889 to 1898. But I guess just as a preface on, you know, James Connolly himself, was just looking to see if you can give a breakdown to, you know, who he was and why he's so remembered amongst both the Irish and Scottish socialists. He's certainly a figure that was kind of my initial pull into the left, if you will, from obviously being here in Scotland, being a Celtic fan and being around the terraces and kind of seeing that name being echoed amongst Irish Republicans and how distinguished they was amongst them, and certainly his kind of understanding of the kind of, as you talked about, the class analysis into the real liberation of Ireland in itself. So just to see if you can give us a breakdown of that.
Yeah, his like where he enters history really, or kind of mainstream kind of history, is his involvement, his crucial and key kind of involvement in the 1916 rising in Ireland, the Easter Rising. He was one of the leaders of it, and he was commander in chief of the armed forces, so of both the IRB and the Irish kind of Citizen Army. But his background is in kind of Marxist republicanism. I wouldn't say he's the founder of it, but he's the first one that I've come across really that really gave it a very firm, like theoretical, anti-colonial, anti-imperialist kind of basis. And that's his kind of innovation, you know. That's his main. That's one of his main kind of like contributions in terms of Irish and British kind of left kind of thinking. He was born in Edinburgh in 1868 of Irish parents, and was brought up in what would be seen as the Irish kind of part of like Edinburgh at that time. So many kind of like Cowgate. He enters into our world in terms of writings in around kind of 1889, 1890. He starts writing to newspapers in like 1891, and his very first kind of published kind of writing, it's called What Is Wealth. So he's 23 kind of years of age, and he's already giving a very firm Marxist kind of analysis of labor and wealth and kind of capitalism. So when we meet him first, he's already a fairly kind of seasoned, not just kind of socialist, but Marxist kind of activist, based in kind of Edinburgh. As was his brother John. His brother John was 6 years older than him. He served in the British Army, and in any of the groups that I've come across in like Edinburgh, they were kind of thick as thieves. So you have kind of John and Jim are constantly, they're always kind of together in terms of kind of organizing. He was a member of the Scottish Socialist Confederation. They were affiliated for a while with the independent, kind of Labour Party that was set up by Keir Hardie, among kind of others. And even though they break that formal link, Connolly doesn't break his links with the Independent Labour Party. And this is something that kind of runs through his entire life. He tries to be as non-sectarian in a left sense as is possible. He will try and work with all kind of left groups, and it is one of his kind of it's one of his kind of continuities. He stands for election in 1894, and he took time off from his job as a carter, as a street cleaner, and he isn't really kind of taken back on. So he tries to make his living as a full-time activist. It doesn't really kind of work out too well in like Edinburgh, and so he makes the move to Dublin in May 1896, where he's central in setting up the Irish Socialist Republican Party, which is the first kind of formal kind of Marxist Republican structure in Ireland. Where he's getting these ideas from is from Edinburgh. So, I mean, this is something that I find kind of fascinating, is that in terms of Connolly's intellectual kind of background, it is that mix that's in Edinburgh. There's an Irish kind of community, but there's also a quite a vibrant radical kind of community, and this helps kind of produce not only James Connolly but like John Connolly as well. So we can almost say that Irish Marxist republicanism was more or less born in like Edinburgh, and then was imported into Ireland via kind of a James Connolly. So with Scotland's gift to Ireland is this mix. And I say that I'm, not in a flippant way. I mean, I like I think what the book kind of shows is that in terms of Connolly's his own kind of intellectual development, he was exceptional, but he wasn't the exception. He was coming from an atmosphere that really speaks to 1890s kind of Edinburgh. By 1903, there are splits and factions in the party, and Connolly is he's voted out of the party that he formed, and he moves to the US, where he's an activist. First, he's a political activist. And then he becomes a trade union kind of activist for the IWW. But by 1910, he's itching to get back to like Dublin, and he comes back, and he it's not soon, and like soon afterwards, he becomes central to Jim Larkin's union, the Irish Transport and like General Workers Union. There's a lockout in Dublin in like 1913 that turns into full blown class war. Comes at It's an international kind of story. And by 1914, with the outbreak of like World War One, you can see kind of Connolly moving towards more of an insurrectionary view of things. And by 1916, he does take part in the 1916 rising. And by some accounts, he was probably he was one of the forces that was pushing for that. In 1916, there's a threat of conscription that was hanging over Ireland, and that seems to have been the impetus for the timing more than anything else. He's wounded during the fighting, and he is executed. He's the last of the leaders. He was executed, and he's executed like sitting down. He's in a chair. They're like because of his wounds. And then after that, he enters into the martyrdom of Irish kind of nationalism. So that's where he more or less kind of sits now. It's this mixture of, there's an argument that's made that Connolly lost his kind of socialism when he walked into the GPO, which was the headquarters of the Irish kind of insurrection in 1916. But as I argue, and I'm not the first by any means, this is no, he was an anti-imperialist, so it made kind of perfect sense. So that's a very superficial overview of a very complex man. So I hope that's okay.
No, that's perfect, Connor, and I just kind of encapsulates Connolly, like, his political journey. It's just really astounding. It is as broad as kind of the work that he done as well. Even his early work in America is kind of, it's fascinating when you read that kind of period, the early 1900s, and then following after that, the kind of figureheads that men like Connolly became, and how they're kind of rich. Pre-rising history is almost entirely forgotten or like kind of brushed aside. It's just that one focal point that's amplified. And the next point I had was kind of on the early years of Connolly, but you've given such a great kind of brief, it's almost rendered it redundant. But
That's true.
I guess to touch on it would be kind of looking at Connolly and going through that political journey himself from like you said, in Edinburgh, even his British Army service, just want to get your view on how important it is not just to recognize that kind of journey, but to document it and the importance that has, I guess, on the movement as a whole.
Well, I mean, there's no evidence that he was in the British Army. Like this is something that I go into in the book. It's an assumption that has been made, but when you go digging, there's absolutely kind of no evidence for it kind of whatsoever. And the main person who was pushed this story was C. Desmond Greaves. And when I went kind of digging into where he kind of based the story on, it's mainly rumors and kind of conjecture. And then more kind of unforgivably, he then invented details in terms of the story in order to make it more kind of credible. So we can say that there's absolutely no evidence that he was in the British Army apart from rumor and conjecture. Rumors that were started by I mentioned that split in the ISRP in like 1903. The right wing faction of that, they're still around in kind of 1912 and like 1913, and they produce a newspaper that is anti Larkin, it's anti James Connolly, and it's anti DITG AWU, and they're the ones who start this rumor that Connolly he was a member of the Monaghan kind of militia. Which was a double, which was a real slur on Connolly, not because of the British Army thing, but the Monaghan kind of militia were infamous in 1798 as being anti-United Irishmen and were instrumental in dampening any form of like uprising in the north in like 1798. So they knew what they were doing, but there's no evidence that he was in the army. I mean, it doesn't change it. I mean, the Connolly we have in our minds is in the British Army, and we think, and it makes no difference as to how we kind of see him. But it's about being honest to the evidence and being honest to the man himself. So there's no evidence, and it's not. And like, you can't prove a negative. So I can't say that he was never in the British Army because you can't prove something that is negative. But it's not up to me to prove that. It's up to those to say that he was, to produce something that shows that he was. And in the 63 years since Greaves published his book claiming that Connolly was in the British Army, not one shred of evidence has been produced to kind of verify that. And when we checked, we're now able to check kind of Greaves's story because his journals are now up online. And we can see from his own kind of accounts how he changed and doctored kind of, even what people who were in their 70s, One was an alcoholic. He was in his 70s, and this is and this was Graves' own kind of a description of him. And then another was about 6 months away from dying, you know, so he was in that kind of like that kind of frame of mind. So in terms of the army story, there is no evidence. You know, his brother was in the army. And like Michael Mallon, he was one of the leaders of the 1916 rising, he served in India in the British Army. So it makes no difference in terms of that, just, you know, it's a reflection of the Irish kind of history itself, like, but there's no evidence for it.
Yeah, no, I think it's as you say there. It's that kind of
It's about
even
being
with
honest to him,
that,
you know what I mean? Like, you
yeah.
know, like going back to your point there around how like one of the impetus for this book has been to kind of get back to a more kind of rounded kind of view of like James Connolly and his environment and where he came from and his own kind of intellectual like innovations and like brilliance, you know. And we have to undo a lot of the damage that has been done over 60, 70, 80, 100 years or so, you know, and this is one part of it.
Yeah, no, bang on. I was just to say that, you know, but it's like you say, even if it was true that he was in the British Army, it doesn't paint him in any worse of a light. If anything,
Makes no difference whatsoever.
could have done a positive on him, if anything.
Yeah.
But it's that importance of the documentation to have, because there's clear documentation, historical record from his time in America, his work in union and party organizing. So yeah, 100%. It's about getting that clear, rounded view as possible and not letting history be rewritten, and figures like Connolly or that be rewritten to suit anybody else's narrative. We want the kind of clearest image possible, to reference in the past, so that we can draw towards, you know, what's needed for the future. So, you know, 100% agreeing, kind of Connolly's history and it being, you know, a true reflection of our journey, because I think there'll be a lot of similarities for folk kind of going in their own personal journeys as well, and looking at heroes like Connolly and whatnot, and seeing their past. So no, 100% agree with that, and just echo your importance in the need to get that clear, rounded figure of Connolly away from any kind of rewriting, or any kind of historical revisionism around events or just his livelihood in general. So no, I think that's bang on, and I guess it kind of leads us to, you know, the Easter Rising, the actual execution of Connolly. Like we said earlier, that the actual 1916 Easter Rising is what he's most personified and magnified in, as opposed to any of his early work. And you know, the mainstream treats him just purely as an Irish Republican, in disregard to his class, or Marxist lens on things. So it's just to see if he'd give us a kind of brief on Connolly's part in the Easter Rising. And you know, the events that led to his execution, and how that kind of played in role with his figure today, and being a just renowned martyr for the Irish cause.
Like what we were able or like what this book kind of shows is that like again there's a mainstream kind of narrative, and it's not just in terms of like centrist or the right wing, it's also in aspects of the left as well, is that like going back to the point that it's argued that James Connolly abandoned his like socialism by embracing Irish Republicanism in like 1915, and somehow, you know, he fell in with a bad crowd, you know. This is kind of idea of that. And you can see it from his writings. It's there from 1895 onwards. You know, it's just there, like, because how I frame it is that where Connolly is able to merge his Marxism isn't just his like socialism, but his Marxism with the Irish kind of nationalist, you know, movement is that it is through his own kind of journey, or the journey of him and his brother and that group that you were members of in Edinburgh, towards what is now seen as a anti-imperialist, anti-colonial kind of Marxism, something that becomes quite more. It rises to the fore after the First World War and really after the Second World War in what is called so-called kind of global South. So you'll get it in terms of Krabal and Amen and Fanon and so forth, and you get these kind of writers who recognize that in a colonial kind of situation, there's a scientific kind of necessity, if you're a Marxist, to be kind of nationalist or to fight for kind of independence, because the very nature of kind of capitalism in your state, it's not just, an off-the-shelf kind of capitalism. It's very much an extractive kind of colonial form of that. So you can't get rid of you can't change the kind of political kind of structures and not change the economic structures from an anti-imperialist kind of point of view, because it's an anti-imperialist presence in your country. So you have to kind of take that on as well. And that's Connolly is making these arguments very, very clearly from 1896, 1897 onwards. And it makes complete sense, his involvement in the 1916 rising, based on that. It's lost. It was lost on aspects of the Scottish and English kind of left. There was a Scottish kind of leader called Tom Johnson. He was involved in I think Justice or yeah in the newspaper kind of Justice or and he actually writes, I don't know why Connolly did this. He's very kind of sympathetic because he knew the man, but basically says, I don't know why Connolly took part in this kind of uprising. And then there's others who went, we know exactly why he did this. It makes complete sense, and including Lenin. Lenin very famously saw completely what Connolly it was about and saw it as an anti-imperialist kind of strike. So you have that kind of view of him. What you get in Ireland from the 1920s onwards is that in the carnival of like reaction, which Connolly kind of warned against in terms of a partition, there's also a quite conservative trade union movement being formed down south. They have a problem with kind of James Connolly because they dismiss Jim Larkin, who's more or less kind of written out of trade union history until the 1970s. But he can't dismiss James Connolly because he's part of the 1916 rising. He's one of the executed kind of 15 leaders. So they have to deal with him somehow. So they turn him into this kind of Christian socialist, kind of trade unionist. And he start cutting his words. So what we find in is that in 1948 there are three from 1948 until 1951 there are four volumes of the Connolly's writings that are brought out, and they're edited by a man called William O'Brien. It will help with kind of Desmond Ryan, and they cut Connolly's words, and they try to cut as much of the socialism and kind of Marxism as he could possibly kind of get away with. So whereas his books and his pamphlets are printed as he wrote them in terms of his articles and his speeches, of which there are around kind of 700, they're changed to try and kind of fit Connolly into a kind of corporatist, conservative kind of trade unionist, and see him only as a trade unionist. And it's quite successful. Those issues are compounded in the late 1990s when Connolly's writings are being transposed onto the internet via the Marxist Internet kind of Archive, because not in all cases, but in many of the articles that are up, and not all of them by any means, but a good proportion of them, they're taken from the William O'Brien versions and not the original ones. So you get reproduced for a whole new generation. A 1940s conservative view of like James Connolly is reborn in the 1990s via the World Wide Web. So it's extremely frustrating. And like even today, there still isn't a complete volume or there isn't a complete kind of collection of his writings. His books and pamphlets are fine. They're anything I've seen of them, they reproduced as the Connolly wrote them. So if you have Labour and the Irish history, there's like that is as kind of Connolly wrote it. But in terms of his articles, these are problematic, but that was not done through error. That was done through ideology. It was trying to fit Connolly somehow into a 1940s Catholic conservative Ireland, which was difficult. So they had to cut him. It's why I kind of argue that somewhat kind of flippantly, but make the point that Eddie Connolly has to be one of the most quoted but least read figures in like Irish history. And we're trying to change that. Have I rambled on kind of, you know, kind of too much there? Nathan, sorry about that.
No, that's good. You're bang on. I mean, it kind of just touches on what we were talking about earlier with that kind of rewriting of history on Connolly's life in itself. And we see that with his actual writings that he's done himself. So it's like you said, it's this actual class attack to kind of liquidate figures like Connolly, to dilute them down, to be, less harmful in that kind of sense. And I guess it kind of comes on to what the next point is on the legacy that Connolly's left behind. It's claimed by so many across both, the left and the right, if you will. And that's we can see that being claimed in they kind of ways. Either it's claimed by the left in the full republishing of his work with that clear class analysis at the forefront and personified, or like you said, it's completely eliminated, diluted down, either as a kind of ideological attack against one of Ireland's most famous martyrs, because it never is done accidentally. You can't just
No.
accidentally get rid of, the clear understanding that Connolly had and kept with him during that time. So I think you're absolutely, bang on there. And I think just to come on to the last point, and because I'll definitely love to let you ramble about your book now, so you've got the full range. So The Lost and Early Writings of James Connolly from 1889 to 1898, just to see if you can give everybody, a rundown of what that encapsulates. And I guess we've talked already the importance of showcasing Connolly's political kind of journey, his writings as well, especially given that, as you've highlighted, they've been under attack or to try to be removed from history, diluted down or pushed to the back. So now's your chance to give us a show of your actual book.
Yeah, well, just before I can delve into it, I just realized there that I left a kind of one kind of a really kind of important point in terms of the Connolly, and just go back to your kind of question about kind of, you know, his legacy and you know how he's used is it's the Troubles. So whereas in the 1940s there was a move to have a certain view of like of kind of James Connolly, this dynamic happens all over again when the Troubles kind of break out in the north in 1969. So you have kind of Connolly, who is now extremely kind of relevant again. But you have kind of various factions who have now this problem with kind of James Connolly, who seems to be speaking to a lot of the issues that are being raised in terms of what is a violent insurrection. All over again, you know, 50 years after what happens in Dublin, but now it's Belfast. And so you have Connolly being used not in terms of his writings, there are no kind of good faith kind of actors here. People are delving into his archives, but they're doing it to find kind of select words to then throw at each other. And I think that's a legacy which we have to, which now with the, you know, with, you know, like 25 years or so after the signing of the Good Friday Agreement, this is, I'm not in any way saying that the North has been solved or anything, but the violence has stopped. And that somehow kind of takes the, that has taken some of the temperature out of the, like out of the whole kind of debate. So we can actually now talk about, you know, Connolly, you know, with some of the temperature kind of, you know, kind of taken down. But like, it would be kind of remiss of me not to mention that Connolly again is then, you know, he's used, you know, people kind of ripping pieces of flesh off him just to throw at each other and getting kind of quite vicious about it, you know. But now, hopefully, we can now kind of delve into his writings. And that's part of the book is kind of trying to get him to to speak on his own terms. So it covers 1889 until 1898, and it reproduces around 60 articles, but I found 18 new pieces of writing in the process of kind of doing this book. 11 new articles, 4 new kind of short stories, and like 3 letters that he wrote to kind of Keir Hardie. So even in terms of the book itself, there's a whole wealth of new writings that are there. And there's another 19 articles that are either republished for the first time in over 100 years, or are can republish in full for the first time in over 800 years, including that republished for the first time the original version of one of Connolly's most famous works, which is Nationalism and like Socialism, which he wrote in 1897. So I think that what the book does is that we're starting to see him in the round, you know, as you said yourself, that kind of earlier on. From the start, we can see that, you know, he's a naturally kind of gifted writer. When he's quite funny, he's quite caustic, he's quite witty. And when you've been edited by dour, humorless, bureaucratic trade unionists, you tend to get a James Connolly who looks a bit like a dour, bureaucratic, humanist, kind of trade unionist. And that has been an absolute crime against him, because he is quite funny. And he's, you know, very kind of sarcastic in a quite kind of brilliant way. As was Marx, of course. You know, I mean, if you read any of like Marx's kind of journalism, you know, like, you know, it's the same thing as well. But we also get a sense of just how incredibly well-read he is. Incredibly, this is the first kind of collection of his writings that is actually fully kind of footnoted. So we even have a kind of situation where not only has Connolly's writings, they haven't been kind of published in the full. Of those kind of collections that are there, he hasn't been kind of footnoted or treated in any kind of scholarly way. And what you get from the footnotes is a sense of just how well read he was. He throws in quotes from writers like all the time. He is particularly fond of Shakespeare and the Bible, which is quite kind of befitting what would be a kind of Marxist preacher on the streets of Edinburgh in the 1890s. And he's, you know, he quotes from Burns, from Dickens, from Walt Whitman, and he sometimes gets these quotes slightly wrong, which I really like, because it shows that it's from memory. He's not just sitting there with a pile of books trying to show off. This is from his own kind of memory and his own kind of reading. So and also you get this merging, this new kind of innovation in terms of his own kind of thinking, where he does take a socialist kind of republicanism and brings it one step further. And he's able to identify in Ireland that there's a certain kind of Catholic kind of middle class that are quite nationalist, but also pro-imperialist. And you've got to watch them. Now, we know from other studies in the last 100 years that this is something that is common with most kind of colonial like situations. You have this kind of compadre, middleman, intermediary class, who are separate from your so-called national kind of bourgeoisie. They are kind of nationalist, but they have 1,000 economic strings with kind of imperialism, and don't want to break them. And Connolly's, you know, he's telling us in the 1890s, watch this class. If they take over, they'll only change the flag over kind of Dublin Castle. They won't do kind of anything else. So whereas you had other socialists, nationalists in Dublin writing about how we need to build kind of socialism in a, you know, under a kind of home rule kind of parliament, Connolly is saying that you're cutting yourself because you don't actually can understand that the economic dynamics in Ireland are not just capitalist, they are colonial capitalist. That's a different beast to Manchester or London or Birmingham or even, so the very extractive nature of a colonial capitalist setup and the classes that emerge out of that. That's Connolly's kind of innovation. He really kind of identifies them. Now, they had been kind of identified as early as the 1840s, but it's lost as knowledge gets lost, it's lost. And Connolly kind of, he, through his own kind of readings and through his own kind of study groups and his own kind of activism, just as a street kind of agitator, is able to do what Marxists should do, which is to see kind of Marxism as a methodology and not as a theology. So he's using it as a methodology, and he's applying it to the actually existing mode of the production in Ireland, seeing that it's colonial mode, and then seeing that they're very particular, the colonial class relations that are beyond the so-called settler and colonial ones, which we're seeing in terms of unionism. He's writing from the 1890s saying, yes, we know about them, but it's the Catholic and the middle classes who are also kind of imperialist. They're the ones, we have to watch, because they're the ones who are leading the independence kind of movement, and they will shape any kind of independent Ireland in their own image, which is precisely what happened. He was completely kind of spot on.
Yeah, no, spot on, Connor. I mean, that's a superb rundown. And I know you've been doing the kind of book launches across both Ireland and even up here in Scotland. How have they been going? And kind of what's been the reception like of the book in itself?
It's been pretty good. We were quite lucky or fortunate to get Camanham Jail for the launch in Dublin, and there's a wonderful clip online of an activist. He stood in election actually for People Before Profit, but Ó Le Canavan, and he sings this amazing kind of version of Where Oh Where Is That Kind of James Connolly in Camanham Jail, and just with the kind of acoustics. It's up online, and it's quite stirring. We had two kind of great launches in like Lighthouse Books in like Edinburgh, and and then one organised by Carlton Books in like Glasgow, and they were my favourite, even more than like Kilmainham. And I'm not just saying that because this is my Spinal Tap, Hello Cleveland moment. I'm not just kind of saying that, but it was because it was that sense of kind of bringing kind of James Connolly home, and that really kind of appealed to me, because I can see that his intellectual kind of development was Edinburgh. Again, with those kind of very particular kind of but dynamics, a quite strong and vibrant Irish kind of immigrant, kind of setting, but also kind of merging with the very strong and vibrant, kind of radical history of Edinburgh and Scotland itself, of very deep and radical kind of thinkers. And out of that kind of merger comes someone like kind of James Connolly. So when I say that, like bringing them home, it's. Yeah, it's really true, I mean, his light blazes, across history when he's in Ireland, but he is formed in Scotland, in like Edinburgh, Now, he always considered himself an Irishman. When he was campaigning there for election in November 1895, he's saying, as an Irishman, I am calling for your vote. He was never, like, this is always kind of part of him. But again, that's part of like Edinburgh, and that's part of its history, is having that kind of Irish kind of identity in a like in a kind of Scottish kind of setting, So like I I genuinely don't think. I think kind of Connolly, he would have been a radical no matter where he was born. But I don't think he would have had access to the same kind of Marxist ideas and kind of conversations if he was in Dublin or in like Monaghan. So I think it is quite important that these mixtures, these did kind of help, you know, make kind of, you know, Deacon James Connolly who we know, and more or less it's all there. So like as I said, it like in the 1890s, his core kind of analysis and his core kind of ideas, they are there. And he didn't make them in Dublin. He brought them to Dublin. So he had to teach those Dublin kind of boyos it just what kind of Marxist republicanism, you know, kind of, you know, it, like actually kind of looked like, you know. So like they've been quite good. They've been quite kind of vibrant. But like, and this is also down to kind of Ishka Books, who've been just kind of amazing. They produced. Have you got a copy of it yet? Have you seen it yet?
Guilty of the sin of not getting your book before doing this podcast. But
no,
thankfully...
it's up online anyway. So like, you know, because no, but like I say that it's just only because they've done. It's a beautiful book, and as they usually do, and it's a wonderful piece of work. But also, it's available online as a free kind of PDF, and that was a real kind of selling point for me in terms of Ishka. One is that they produce really kind of, you know, kind of cutting edge anti-imperialist kind of Marxist thinking at the moment anyway. So like, you know, Connolly, like if he belongs anywhere, he belongs there, I think. Secondly, they produce their beautiful books. But thirdly, they also have this thing that all the books are available as free to like download, and that really kind of appealed to me, because I can't on one hand bemoan the versions of Connolly that are available free online and then put a paywall up for, you know, for access for the so-called kind of corrected, you know, versions. So so the Gishka books have been kind of amazing, you know. And it's informal still, but we are talking about carrying on and doing another four volumes, which takes us up to 1916. But no contracts have been signed yet, so we have to see. But I think they're happy as well, so we see what happens. It's certainly like it's been a good marriage kind of so far anyway.
Yeah, no, that's great to hear, Conan. Yeah, I'm guilty of this in an old bang your book before doing this, but
no,
thankfully
but
I'm in Dublin this week, so I'll be able to pick up for quite fittingly Connolly books. So
oh, Connolly
I'll
books,
do you a service there.
Yeah, say hi to Aaron, if you know, they're for me as well. So yeah, but the Connolly books in Dublin. If people don't know it, you know, it's an institution anyway. But they've been brilliant. They've been just so supportive. And Aaron and Eugene as well. They've been absolutely brilliant, you know, like in terms of like stocking it. It's the only, there are two shops in Dublin that are stocking it, and it's mainly Connolly books, and then it's Alan Hannah's in like Rathmines. But they're the only ones who are stocking it. So yeah, they're quite brilliant. Big fans of the Connolly books here.
Oh, good stuff. And also, I love that sentiment you made about kind of bringing Connolly home to the likes of Scotland. So that does sound lovely. And I'm gutted as well that I missed out on both the book launches in Edinburgh, sadly being away to Poland for that. But from what I've seen and to those I've spoke to who have purchased your book and have began to read it, is that it does do that service of capturing, like you said, Connolly's intellectual development, the knowledge that he did have even at that time, as well as, like you say, his charisma, his personal kind of commitment to seeing that emancipation for the working class, you know. So it's, again, it falls back to everything we've kind of talked about, that importance of documenting this, to see kind of characters like Connolly and their humanity first and foremost, because obviously we in the left kind of put these people on massive pillars, and quite rightly so, in my opinion. But to see them as, you know, the human beside you to that person on the shop floor, you know, that's the kind of real tone that you want as well to kind of capture. So It's been
Well, I mean,
fantastic to hear.
yeah, I mean, well, you know, it's like on that point about kind of like putting Connolly like up on a pedestal. Like before we started on this volume of it, I transcribed all of his writings anyway, just to make sure, because like I had this kind of a project in mind of kind of republishing all of his writings for the Ready for His Time. So it's been kind of 18 months, and I transcribed everything that's known. It's around 800,000 words. So everything from 1889 up to 1916. So this is the first volume of that. And it's only like 10% of that. But the reason being was that I needed to know that this was doable, and also because we've been here before, where people have to come on and said, now's the time to publish all of kind of James Connolly's kind of writings. So I didn't want to be kind of that person who just like says this, that this needs to be done, does one book, and then that's it, because it's just too kind of overwhelming. I have it all. It's all in kind of one file. It's all about kind of, you know, kind of footnoting, and it's all rough. But that's my long way of saying is that you cannot read 800,000 words by anyone and not realize that they've got feet of clay. And I think that is kind of important. That I think by volume five, we will have a more kind of rounded view of like James Connolly, stuff that he got right and then stuff that he might have gotten wrong. And that's good, because then like he turns into what I think, where with this is my background, but where I see him as like how I see kind of James Connolly. And like the reason why I'm doing this project is that like I write books on kind of Irish kind of capitalism. But how I see history is how is from a Marxist way, which is that you see history, it's a canvas that allows you to observe deep social and economic forces in motion. So I'm able to look at Connolly talking about this class in the 1890s. I can really kind of patter O'Donnell in the 1930s, also talking about this class. And then I can see them in my own work then as well. And then that helps me chart this kind of middleman, compadre, intermediary class through a Marxist kind of methodology. So for me, he's a brilliant resource, because he's a Marxist in the 1900s. In the 1900s, phoning it in, telling us what he's seeing, and then we can take that kind of information and help chart from a Marxist, you know, kind of perspective, what are the actually existing class kind of dynamics on the island of Ireland, because you need that time frame. Same as kind of climate studies, and you can't see how kind of climate changes over kind of 1 year or the like 10 years. Like you need that kind of 1 year kind of framework. So it's kind of gives us that. So then that I think helps kind of put him back on to where he belongs, I think, which is, you know, as a Marxist Republican, doing what Marxists should be doing, which is seeing Marxism as a methodology to understand the world in order to change it, in order to change that world, rather than as a theology where you find quotes just to fling at each other, you know. So hopefully, you know, he'd be brought back into that kind of methodology that, you know, it, you know, like there as well. And he's a brilliant practitioner of Marxism. So I think we have a lot to like learn from him from that kind of, you know, that way as well.
Yeah, no, absolutely spot on there, Conor. I don't think I could even add anything to that. That's a great kind of analysis of it. So I guess just to finish off with kind of any final talking points from yourself, and most importantly, where can we find you on social media, and as well as the best place to buy your actual book?
Yeah, the best place is those kind of physical shops, if people can. Just not everyone can. But the reason being is that even going back to that kind of to the various kind of book launches, I mean, this shows the absolute importance of like radical kind of bookshops, because I simply wouldn't have a venue for launches or kind of discussions if it were not for Carlton Books and I am like Lighthouse Books, the Connolly books, you know, as well. Now that's not an option for everyone. But if people can, you know, buy their copies in these kind of shops, I'm doing a launch on Wednesday. I'm speaking on Wednesday, the 11th of like December, and it's in Houseman's Books in like London, so they'll be stocking it there as well. But then if it's online, if it's UK, like Carlton Books, it cover you know, like online kind of orders. And then outside of that, it's your online kind of retailers. But if people can like try and kind of support those radical networks, you know, like I think, you know, like that would speak to the politics of the James Connolly, you know, there as well. We need a Carlton Books, we need kind of Lighthouse Books, and we need kind of Connolly Books to kind of survive and kind of keep kind of thriving, you know.
Yeah, no, fantastic. I'll definitely be sure they can include the links to all of them in the description as well, and even on Twitter for the post. So, no, again, just want to say thank you again, Connor, for taking the time to
Oh.
come on the show. I know you're a busy man, especially promoting this new book, so it's really appreciated you taking the time to come on here.
That was a pleasure. That's no problem at all.
Thanks again, comrades, for tuning in to another episode of Spectre. As always, be sure to leave us a like and review on whatever platform you're listening in on. Be sure to share this with your friends, co-workers, comrades, and anyone else you know. The importance of books like Dr. Conor McCabe's can't be understated. It's vital that we document the political journey of those we hold in such a pedestal. Dr. McCabe's writings offer a rare glimpse into Connolly's evolving political thought as he navigated the fight for workers' rights, socialism, and Irish independence. All this done through a sharp critique of capitalism and imperialism, in which Connolly laid the intellectual groundwork for the radical movements that would later define his legacy. And that is why we must remember Connolly's legacy and the legacy left by so many like him in the fight against British imperialism and colonialism. It's vital that we keep class at the centre when we see injustices committed by our own nations abroad. Connolly understood this, and so did many men in the movement of the Irish Republic. Connolly knew that just the removal of the British Army did not alone guarantee emancipation for the working class. In Connolly's own words, "If you remove the English Army tomorrow and hoist the green flag over Dublin Castle, unless you set about the organisation of the Socialist Republic, your efforts will be in vain. England will still rule you. She would rule you through our capitalists, through our landlords, through her financiers, through the whole array of commercial and individualist institutions she has planted in this country and watered with the tears of our mothers and the blood of our martyrs." So let's keep the legacy of men like Connolly alive. Let's keep the fire of the working class alive, burning brightly in Ireland, Scotland, England, or Wales. Let's keep the fires burning across the globe to squash out imperialism, capitalism, and all its decaying tortures. Let's fight like Connolly for the emancipation of the working class.
A great crowd had gathered outside of Kilmaida, their heads all uncovered, they knelt to the ground. For inside that grim prison lay a brave Irish soldier, his life for his country about to lay down. He went to his death like a true son of Ireland. The firing party he bravely did face. Then the order rang out, present arms and fire. James Connolly fell into a ready-made grave. The black flag was hoisted, the cruel deed was over. Gone was the man who loved Ireland so well. There was many a sad heart in Dublin that morning when they murdered James Connolly, the
Irish wild band. God's curse on you, England, you cruel-hearted monster. Your deeds, they would shame all the devils in hell. There are no flowers blooming, but the shamrock is growing on the grave of James Connolly, the Irish werebell. The four courts at Dublin, the English bombarded, the spirit of freedom they tried hard to quell. But above all the dead rose the cry of surrender towards the voice of James Connolly, the Irish were bad.